Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 328. Welcome back. This week, we've got a really great program. I've got a really great article that was written by Manly P. Hall in his own magazine back in 1931. Now, we've also got a piece that I did for the Midnight Freemasons, and illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison will stop by with a segment from the Masonic Minute, so it's going to be a really good show. Before we get started in this episode, I did want to mention just a few things. First, a huge special thanks goes out to past Grandmaster John Hess of Missouri and illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison for an incredible episode of Masonic Curators. If you haven't watched that episode, you should really check it out. He's got some items there that are Missouri specific, but really reach across the United States. I've received a number of compliments on that episode, and so we really know that we enjoyed that. I enjoyed it immensely, and it was just an honor to have them on the program. It was great. So hopefully you are enjoying these episodes. I would urge you to consider making your own Masonic Curator video and sending it on over. Brother David Connolly has recently done this as well. He has some really great Masonic razors that he's going to showcase for us. And that video will be going up this week. And I think you guys will all thoroughly enjoy it. So on another announcement, Brother Levi Banker of Banker's Best. So buybankersbest.com, one of our huge sponsors for this program, has a new product out. He just released a beard wash / shampoo. It's amazing stuff. Brother Banker does not put out a bad product. Head on over to buybankersbest.com, or better yet, go to wcypodcast.com and go through our links to get on Banker's Best, the website, and do your purchasing there. That way you also help support this show. I know I'm going to go ahead and pick up some, because I go through beard wash shampoo pretty frequently. So let's go ahead and get started this week on the program. First up, we're going to just do a deep dive right into a great article that was written by Manly P. Hall. It was part of his monthly magazine, which was called The All-Seeing Eye. The magazine was devoted to the search for those fundamental varieties existing in the educational systems, religions, and philosophies of all ages. And this came out of Volume 5 from January of 1931, and it's number 4. You can find this article in its entirety at iapsop.com, and you just do a search for the occult periodicals. The Atlantis, The Lost World. There is a persistent rumor that the age-old legend of Atlantis has intrigued the curiosity of no less a person than Ambassador Charles G. Dawes, whose underslung pipe and efforts to Americanize the court of St. James have already brought him a considerable measure of distinction. In a clipping at hand, it is stated that the Honorable Mr. Dawes is so impressed with the Atlantis idea that he has financed a search of the Vatican Library in hopes of discovering among the musty old documents there some key to the enigma. The investigation, which is being carried on by a Yale scholar, is particularly concerned with the Mayan dialect. The hypothesis is that if the secrets of this language can be uncovered, it may be then possible to decipher at least some of the many strange inscriptions in the Yucatan and Guatemala which have so far baffled archaeologists. The ex-vice president entertains the hope that the strange hieroglyphics deeply cut into the walls of temples or into the faces of monuments will, when correctly read, forever settle the Atlantis problem. Is it possible that Ambassador Dawes has been reading with profit certain sections of Baldwin's Ancient America? For example, the following sentences are illuminating. Quote, "The two words Atlas and Atlantis have no satisfactory etymology in any language known to Europe. They are not Greek and cannot be traced to any known language of the quote-unquote Old World." End quote. The conclusion is inevitable. If the Old World is of no assistance to the matter, try the New World. Again, the point of attack is clearly indicated. The only part of the New World which apparently developed any historical instinct or perpetuated any systematic record was Central America, a term which, for our purposes, will extend to cover Mexico and the northern parts of South America. Those who scoff at the idea of a submerged Atlantic continent must first of all explain away the descriptions given by Plato in the Critias and the Timaeus. Plato's accounts carry considerable weight, inasmuch as the integrity and learning of that philosopher cannot easily be assailed. Up to the beginning of the 16th century, designers of maps included the Atlantean island in their charts and globes simply on the authority of Plato. The anti-Atlantists, however, contend that the Critias Plato takes a flight into fiction, quote, manuring, to use Plutarch's words, the little seed of the Atlantis myth, which Solon had discovered in the Egyptian temples. But now, etymology rises up to discomfort the scoffers, for had Plato or any of the Greeks fabricated this account, they would unquestionably have used a word derived from their own speech to designate the last continent. The same would be true of the Egyptians. In Isis Unveiled, H.P. Blavatsky calls attention to the fact that both the story of Atlantis and the name of the country itself came to the Greeks as historical inheritance of the most remote antiquity. The Egyptian priests told Solon that the accounts of Atlantis which they possessed had been deciphered from inscriptions upon ancient columns. These pillars, composed of some unknown and imperishable substance, possibly the fabled Pillars of Enoch, had been erected before the deluge. In fact, the columns had been constructed for the express purpose of withstanding the terrific upheavals which were to lay barren a considerable part of the earth. Crantor, writing circa 300 BC, declared that at that time the pillars were still in existence. In 1912, M. Pierre Termier, a member of the Academy of Science and Director of Service of the Geologic Chart of France, delivered a remarkable lecture on Atlantis before the Institut Oceanographique. This lecture was later translated and published in the annual report of the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian Institution for the year ending June 30, 1915. The valiant French savant declared, quote, "It seems more and more evident that a vast region, continental or made up of great islands, has collapsed west of the Pillars of Heracles." End quote. M. Termier's reasons were purely geological and have been well substantiated by subsequent findings. Theopompus and Marcellus, ancient historians, refer to both a continent and islands in the Atlantic Ocean. Marcellus writes of 7 small islands and 3 great ones, which together constituted the Atlantides. Confusion is continually arising as to whether the 7 islands mentioned were actually 7 independent land areas or merely 7 national divisions of the great continent itself. Many volcanic cataclysms occurred before the last upheaval, which finally destroyed Poseidonis, the name given to the last form of the great oceanic continent. The Azores Islands are now regarded as remnants of the mountain peaks of Poseidonis. It is possible that Poseidonis was the land of mud, which, in the Troano Codex, an early writing of the Mayan of the Yucatan, was destroyed in the year 6 Khan on the 11th Mulak in the month Zak. Whether this figure can be reconciled with the date of the Atlantean destruction as preserved by Plato, which would be about 9,500 BC, is a matter which only time can determine. But when the Codex declares that the land of mud was sacrificed, that 10 countries were torn asunder and scattered and finally sank, carrying their 64 million inhabitants with them, it should be remembered that 10 countries coincides exactly with the number of islands described by Marcellus and the 10 kingdoms described by Plato. Having exhausted the possibilities of the Greek and Egyptian writings, at least until more records come to light, we are justified in turning to the peoples of the old Americas for such information as they may possess on this fascinating subject. There is much evidence of Atlantean blood among the Red Indians, the Bering Strait migration theory notwithstanding. It is highly possible that the Asiatic tribes also reached this country and by the mingling of 2 definite strains of blood produced what we now term the American Indian race. In fact, more than 2 races may be represented in their bloodstream. John Johnson, Esquire, in Archaeologia Americana, says that the Chineos, an Algonquin tribe, have a tradition that their ancestors crossed the sea. These same peoples preserved for many centuries an annual ceremony in celebration of the deliverance, but it is impossible to discover the nature of the evil which they providentially escaped. The catastrophe must have been of considerable import to become the subject of such perpetuation. May it have been their escape from the sinking Atlantis? Schoolcraft and the Indian tribes of the United States, writing of the North American Indians as a group, says they relate, generally, that there was a deluge at an ancient epoch which covered the earth and drowned mankind except a limited number. Even the Chinese perpetuate an account of the flood, and, as it is quite evident that the earth's surface was never entirely inundated, all these accounts may be traced to the Atlantean catastrophe. There is no more significant fragment bearing on the subject than the famous speech which Montezuma, the Mexican king, delivered to Cortez, the Spanish conqueror, quote, "I would have you to understand before you begin your discourse that we are not ignorant or stand in need of your persuasions to believe that the great prince you obey is descended from our ancient Quetzalcoatl, lord of the seven caves of the Nahuatlacs, and lawful king of those seven nations which gave beginning to our Mexican empire." End quote. In several of the Mexican codices, the origin of the people is symbolically set forth by diagrams showing seven irregular circles, presumably intended to represent caverns. In each of these is a twisted-up human figure resembling an embryo, and these seven are the progenitors of the race. If we are bold enough to claim that these so-called caverns really signified islands or continents, we shall not be more daring than Colonel Hamilton Smith, who advances this same hypothesis in his learned work, The Natural History of the Human Species. It should be quite evident that when Montezuma refers to Quetzalcoatl as the Lord of the Seven Caves, he does not intend to convey that this divine man, Prince Feathered Serpent, was literally a ruler over seven holes in the ground. It is a common legend among the red men that their progenitors came out of holes in the earth, ascending from their dark retreats to escape a flood or deluge loosed by one of the gods on the underworld. Such an account might well imply that these Indians had originally inhabited the lowlands but had fled to the mountains to escape the terrible tidal waves caused by the Atlantean disaster, and which unquestionably, at least temporarily, inundated great areas of the earth. Plato infers that the Atlantean deluge was loosed by the gods because of the sins of men. In the American Indian legends, the flood from which the red men escaped in various ways was also an act of retribution on the part of the great Manito. Referring to Montezuma's speech to Cortez, Schoolcraft notes that in speaking of Quetzalcoatl, or Lord of the Seven Caves, it is probably implied that he was the lawful chief of seven bands, tribes, or nations. He was the feathered snake, metamorphosed into a god by the peoples to whom he brought culture and enlightenment. There is evidence that the rulers of Atlantis were known as the Serpent Kings, probably the Winged Serpents, as a tribute to the royalty. In the old traditions, it is written that the serpent originally walked upright, but because of his pride and sin, he fell. The occult traditions further declare that in an ancient age there were winged serpents upon the earth. These may well have been the famous Atlantean sorcerers described in Oriental secret traditions. Among the Portuguese, there is a legend of a mysterious island called by them Ilha das Sete Cidades, the Island of the Seven Cities, or Antilla. Are these seven cities the seven golden cities of Cibola, which the Spanish sought for their conquest of Lower California? Are they also the original seven cities ruled over by the feathered serpents or winged seraphs? The thought of the serpents is not so far-fetched when we remember that the Arab geographers always referred to Antilla or Atlantis as the Dragon's Isle. Was the dragon the great king, Thivatat, the mysterious spirit who ruled Atlantis from the air and was unseen at any time according to the ancient traditions, and whose agents upon the earth were the serpent kings who carried his feathered scepter as symbols of their regency? If so, then the natural symbol for this dragon king, lord of the seven cities or nations, would be the seven-headed serpent, which is perpetuated today as the famous seven-headed Naga of Cambodia. Thus, the Atlantean Empire is represented by a strange dragon whose heads represent the sources of the race and whose long coils reveal the migrations of the Atlanteans in their serpentine path across the world. The account of Atlantis being under the dominion of a great invisible being may have given rise to certain Celtic legends, particularly those dealing with the account of how Ireland was originally peopled by an invisible race and ruled over by an aerial king. These myths may have come to Ireland by way of the quote-unquote men from the sea, accounts of whom have been preserved in their traditions. These men were the Atlantean sorcerers, or snakes, whom St. Patrick was supposed to have destroyed. Both Homer and Horace apparently sensed the allegorical import of Atlantis, for by reading between the lines, one gathers from their writings the impressions that, to them, Atlantis signified a superior universe or higher world, possibly the one which descended into matter when the physical universe was created. created. Hence the fable to Eden, or that antediluvian sphere referred to in scriptures as ruled over by the kings of Edom. Atlantis thus becomes the Elysian Fields, or the abode of the blessed, and is called by the Welsh Avalon. The Atlantides, or Seven Islands, are described by early mythologists as the Seven Pleiades, daughters of Atlas, for they were lifted out of the depths upon the shoulders of the great giant of the earth. In order that the wide extent of the Atlantis story may be better appreciated, for traditional accounts of both the continent itself and the disaster which destroyed it have been preserved among nearly all civilized peoples, consider the words of Louis Chevalier, a French writer on Oriental philosophies, in his Histoire des Vergès. Quote, "A religious belief common to Malacca and Polynesia, that is to say, to the two opposite extremes of the oceanic world, affirms that all these islands once formed two immense countries, inhabited by yellow men and black men, always at war, and that the gods, wearied with their quarrels, having charged ocean to pacify them, the latter swallowed up the two continents, and since then it has been impossible to make him give up his captives." End quote. The other continent referred to by M. Chevalier is unquestionably Lemuria, a great area of land which is said to have disappeared prior to the sinking of Atlantis, leaving only the Australasian archipelago. Fragmentary information concerning these continents is continually coming to light into different parts of Asia, and geology again confirms the old traditions. A discussion of Atlantis would be incomplete without a brief outline of the causes for its disappearance. The great king, Thivatat, the invisible dragon, is unquestionably what Eliphas Levi would call the quote-unquote astral light, the same force which the Knights Templars were accused of worshipping under the form of the Goat of Mendes. The astral light is the seat of sorcery, or what the ancients termed infernal magic. The ruler of this sphere is the great fire prince Samael, who is supposed to have taken upon himself the form of a serpent and seduced Eve. His sphere is ruled by Mars, or more correctly symbolized by it, and his keyword is ambition. The Atlanteans were natural clairvoyants, or it might be better to say natural mediums. They could see the invisible worlds, but they did not understand the proper use of the great forces of the astral light. It will be noted that nearly all Aboriginal peoples worship various forms of demons and elemental spirits, also the ghosts of the dead. The present red and black primitive races of Atlantean and Lemurian origin and their demon gods are the creatures which their progenitors actually saw in the astral light. By various forms of magic, many of these tribes can still control these elemental beings in the astral light. The question as to what caused the destruction of Atlantis is then very simply answered. Atlantis never produced a philosopher. But the question may be asked, how can an individual or race possess supernatural powers without philosophy? This question can be answered by another. Why are mediums so often illiterate and having so little knowledge of the affairs of the living still talk with the dead? The Atlanteans, like the medium, did not possess supernatural power technically. They were possessed by it. They were moved by the astral king like Ouija boards, and as his fear was once of excess and fury, he poured forth his qualities through them until the whole civilization collapsed in a common ruin. Before the destruction of the continent, the Atlanteans were divided, for in a portion of the people was born the realization of a personal responsibility. These escaped from the rulership of the Dragon King and obeying the instructions of the Great White Lord, prepared for themselves a better destiny. When the destruction came and the fire which the sorcerers had invoked consumed them, the white adepts led by the great father of the Thinkithians, quote, Noah, escaped and established themselves in those lands which had survived the great destruction. The demon king Thivatat did not always control Atlantis. He gradually gained dominion over it as an evil habit gradually gains control of a human life. He finally obsessed Atlantis and those of the Atlantean adepts, superior beings who incarnated in Atlantis to protect the people, who could no longer protect the continent from the demon of the astral light, became the leaders of the several migrations. These adepts were also termed serpents, but with them the serpent had been raised, as is described in the Bible. It had not lost its feet, as shown in the Egyptian glyphs, and it wore the feather of Maat, the symbol of truth. Quetzalcoatl, whose proper symbol is an upraised snake, and whose carried the cross, was one of the white adepts, for it declared, in the codices that he was a quote-unquote white man, a term which may not necessarily mean the color, rather the purity. To return again to the modern time, an interesting note appears in the July 1930 number of Popular Mechanics magazine. In an article, The Hunt for the Lost Atlantis by Leslie O'Rear, two paragraphs are representative. Quote, "Already there have been wrested from the sea the secrets of several ancient cities that were submerged by some unrecorded catastrophe, and what those discoveries have revealed inspired Count Byron Kuhn de Prorok, famed archaeologist, to organize, in collaboration with French and American institutions, this new expedition in search for the lost Atlantis. Count de Prorok will search for Atlantis equipped with a diving bell that can descend 2,500 feet, a laboratory facility, machine guns for land giants which they expect to encounter in certain parts of the Sahara, Tuaregs, a fierce tribe, presumably the last of the Atlanteans, 140-foot yacht, grappling apparatus, wireless equipment, a submarine, and an aeroplane. The Count himself says, quote, "We embark upon this romantic quest confident that we shall give it to the world some insight into the most ancient civilization of all time, the lost Atlantis." From all this, it is evident that the interest in this ancient problem is increasing daily and must continue until the solution is found. Atlantis demands its place in history. It is the missing link in the great chain of civilization, without which many of the greatest mysteries of anthropology must remain unsolved. Also, as Ignatius Donnelly reminded us, Atlantis is the unsuspected basis of nearly all great world mythologies, with their weird tales of giants and demons battling for ages against the gods. It is my intention to prepare a companion article to this one to deal with the Atlantis and as an element in philosophy rather than the element in history, not to disprove the existence of Atlantis as a continent, but to show that the historical account is used by Plato to cover certain mysteries of the soul, which, as an initiate, he could only reveal through symbols. In the meantime, we will conclude this brief resume with a climax of M. Termier's address to the Institut Oceanographique. Quote, "I dream of the last night of Atlantis, to which perhaps the last night, that great night of humanity, will bear semblance. The young men have all departed for the war. Beyond the islands of the Levant and the distant pillars of Hercules, those who remain, men of mature age, women, children, old men, and priests, anxiously question the marine horizon, hoping there to see the first sails appearing, heralds of the warrior's return. But tonight the horizon is dark and vacant. How shadowy the sea grows, how threatening is the sky so overcast. The earth for some days has shuddered and trembled. The sun seems rent asunder, here and there exhaling fiery vapors. It is even reported that some of the mountain craters have opened, whence smoke and flames belch forth and stones and ashes are hurled into the air. Now, on all sides, a worn gray powder is raining down. Night has quite fallen. Fearful darkness, nothing can be seen without lighted torches. Suddenly seized with blind terror, the multitude rushed into the temples. But lo, even the temples crumble, while the sea advanced and invades the shore, its crew clamoring loud above all the other noise. What takes place might indeed be the divine wrath. Then quiet reigns no longer. Are there either mountains or shores? No longer anything save the restless sea asleep under the tropic sky." End quote. So there you have this really cool article about Atlantis coming from Manly P. Hall. There are going to be people out there, you know, you're listening to this and you're like, what does that have to do with Masonry? So other than Manly P. Hall being a prolific Masonic author, we had mentions to several items that are reported to have existed. The Pillars of Hercules, the pillars that they refer to, these Pillars of Enoch, these are very prominent in Masonic lodges. These are those two pillars. These are those pillars that were prepared to survive conflagration and inundation, so fire and flood. It is very interesting. Does our ritual really allude to something older? Possibly. No doubt that our ritual is a work of fiction of sorts. It is a drama play, not unlike the many that came before it. But I felt that it was a fun topic, it was a fun paper, and really, Manly P. Hall made some interesting connections there that I hope spin your wheels a little bit. So next, let's go right into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison.
You are a scientist. I am a scientist. In fact, I have a framed piece of paper from a major university on my office wall declaring, I am a scientist. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that I am a Freemason. Have you ever considered that as Freemasons, we are all scientists? You are indeed a scientist. Welcome to the club. Consider the winding staircase. The closer you get to the top, the closer you get to the natural sciences and their tools. Logic. Science cannot survive without logic. Arithmetic. Mathematics is the basis of many branches of science. It is the language of the study of the universe. Geometry. The root of our craft, upon which our skills and symbols are developed and based. Astronomy. The fabric of the universe and the science which reveals its grandeur. You are a spiritual individual. I am a spiritual individual. And, like we said before, I'm talking about the fact we are Freemasons. We were asked in whom we put our trust, and our answers revealed our spirituality. You may have heard there is some sort of conflict between spirituality, or if you will, religion and science. Well, it can't exist within the hearts of millions of Freemasons. Through symbolism, observation, and study, we understand they are related and complement each other. I am intrigued by the experience of Dr. Eben Alexander, a neurosurgeon, no less, who admitted to being a marginal, skeptical Christian. He clinically died of meningitis and was revived into a comatose state. Some doctors claim near-death experiences are a function of the dying brain. But Dr. Alexander was measured to have no brain activity at all, and yet had an amazing journey through what he calls the realms of heaven. The journey couldn't have been a hallucination in his brain, since it was completely inactive. After a week, he returned to consciousness and told his story in his book, Map of Heaven. In it, as he vividly describes heaven, he says, nothing is isolated in heaven. Nothing is disconnected. Everything is one. Everything is connected to everything else. He is almost describing a phenomenon scientists call quantum entanglement, whereby quantum particles that have had previous interaction will continue to instantly interact no matter the distance between them, even if it is millions of light years. They are connected. They are one. An interaction on one will be sensed by the other instantly. This is no pipe dream. This has been observed and proven by experiment. Einstein himself could not explain it, calling it spooky action at a distance. If Einstein couldn't explain it, I'm sure none of us can. There is so much we don't know that rests on the threshold of the physical universe and heaven. a conflict between science and spirituality? Not at all. By our science, we may curiously trace nature through her various windings to her most concealed recesses. By it, we discover the wisdom, power, and goodness of the grand architect of the universe and view with delight the proportions which connect this vast machine. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that awesome piece by illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. If you're so inclined, please head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on the From Us to You tab, and then go ahead and click into the bookstore, and there you'll find all of Steve Harrison's excellent books right there for purchase. While you're on our website, if you feel so inclined, please check out the Support the Show links. Just hover over Support the Show and check out any number of ways to support the show. Whether you'd like to set up a donation schedule on a monthly basis, or you'd like to give a one-time donation, or perhaps buy a lapel pin that is featured on our show. It is a unique pin that only is available through us. It's not something you're going to find out at Mackey's or any of these other fine retailers. It's just for us, and it is specific to our show and funding so that we can bring you all this great content week after week. So, thanks very much for checking that out. Next, I've got a piece that I wrote for the Midnight Freemasons last week. It was a piece that I sat on for quite a while. I didn't know how I wanted to approach it. I knew what I wanted to say, and so I just tried to write it out as best I could. And I got a lot of traction, and I hope it speaks to everybody out there. It's called What If We Actually Did Masonry? And it's by myself, Robert H. Johnson. What if we actually did Freemasonry? We've all been there, a meeting where everyone has to put in their 2 cents regarding a charity event or a lodge repair, a discussion that lasts 20 minutes too long, men informing the lodge that they quote-unquote know a guy who can do it cheaper, or perhaps raising the dues $5 a year is too expensive, or still yet, perhaps it's about how much money is going to be earmarked for the upcoming scholarships. I commend these brothers who dig into the nitty-gritty of lodge minutiae. It's something I've just never cared much about or felt I needed to contribute to. These guys are into it, though. They do it without being prompted. They take ownership and are made sure that their voices are heard. The title of this article alludes to the core mission of Freemasonry, to make good men better. Yes, we're charitable. Yes, we serve our communities, but what are we teaching our members about actually improving men? I addressed this concern in a previous piece, which you can read here. In it, I am alluding to the What Freemasonry Teaches, We Don't Know article. What if, though? What if that same gusto for discussing these things, building maintenance and pancake breakfasts, was had when we introduced Masonic education? What if Masonic education wasn't met with eye rolls from around the lodge? What if people cared as much for Masonic education as they do about the minutiae? What if worshipful masters didn't buckle under the stress of the membership requiring Masonic education to be the mere 5 minutes or less? What if we did what we're supposed to do, and fulfilled the membership in a Masonic way, through improvement and education? What if instead of being told that we should start a study club on off night for Masonic education, we just embraced the present opportunity to affect all present? What would happen if we all changed the order of business so that Masonic education came right after the opening? What would happen if we spent 20, 30, dare I say an hour on a topical presentation complete with questions and answers with discussion from the brothers? Maybe we just change it so that it's all education and only a couple bills. What would happen if these brothers were as engaged in the educational topic as they are about replacing the toilet seat or procuring the free pancake mix from the local restaurant? Would the previous discussed minutiae be seen as the 5-minute bastard of the meeting, relegated to the end, much like education is in too many lodges? The chances are we would lose a lot of members by doing this. In fact, because Freemasonry is many different things to many different people, the least of which is an educational system, to do these things we would require some sort of drastic change within the organization. Perhaps the way to experience this for those interested is to start a new lodge based on these principles. Recently, there's been some great conversation about members who are unsatisfied starting their own lodges. In some cases, Grand Lodges have asked the members, rather than walk away, why not start a new lodge? Members took that advice. Members across the United States are taking that advice. Perhaps something that needs to be considered here is that Freemasonry should serve to fulfill its membership. Instead, what occurs is that the membership is largely guilted into not giving up on the current lodge, not walking away and actually to double and triple down and urge to join all the other appendant bodies. These extra organizations which are looking for anyone at all to convey the degrees upon, many times in an abbreviated form just to get a warm body in a position. Brother Scott S. Duball made a case for that in his piece, Blue Lodge First. Above, I asked a whole lot of questions, and in my imagination I thought about all the responses that I would likely get online and the things which would be talked about, if at all. I just couldn't help but think to myself that the responses would be something like, I wouldn't go to lodge anymore. Or perhaps, by doing education first or by pushing hard for Masonic education like this, you're being unbrotherly. I don't know how that would be true, but that's basically what I think I'd hear. I think those imaginary, but prophetic responses I mentioned earlier are why the idea would never work. It's why the membership that's out there should just go ahead and start a new lodge if they want the educational kind of experience. Focus on what you want and leave the rest behind until they learn to attract you through additional fulfillment, not by begging you to show up. Have doubts about how this works? Check out Admiration Chapter of Royal Arch Masons in Eastern Illinois, or ask Homer Lodge, also in Eastern Illinois, about having education right after opening up and letting it go for, quote, as long as it goes, according to Todd E. Creason, founder of the Midnight Freemasons. In fact, recently, Todd had let me know that one of their chief detractors in the beginning of this effort recently came to him and Greg Knott to tell them how much that they now look forward to the meetings. While some reading this might belong to an education-focused lodge and have no issues, I assure you, you are the minority. I have said it before and I'll say it again. If Freemasonry is indeed a system which teaches good men to be better, then we better start having more education meetings than degrees in business combined. If we're not doing this, we're just lip service. All right, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed. We'll have links to the articles and anything else that we've mentioned in the show right there in the show notes. I hope you enjoyed. If you like Masonic podcasts, I know you do, you're listening to this one, please don't forget to check out the Masonic Roundtable, which goes live every Tuesday at 10, 9 Central. Now, there are a number of great Masonic podcasts out there, and we love them all. So check them out. They're great. You can check out a bunch of links to some of the ones that have been out in the past. We still have a blog page up. It's called masonicpodcastnetwork.blogspot.com. That's out there. And we may be upgrading that, maybe doing some fun stuff with that in the future. But also, there's a plethora of other new Masonic podcasts out there. Notably, one of my favorites is Historical Light, which is done by Alex Powers. Big high five to Alex for all the hard work he's putting in. Really appreciate it. And he's a real inspiration. He's kind of the inspiration behind Masonic Curators, along with Brother Scott Duball. So please check out those. I will also mention that I have a correction to my schedule of events. I will also be at another chapter meeting out in Virginia in May. Good old brother Joe Martinez is having me out, and I'm really excited to go out there and hang out with Joe and all the brothers. And I'll be in the neighborhood. I'll be able to see brother John Ruark and brother Jason Richards as well, hopefully. So with all that, if you have any questions about the upcoming schedule or the shows or anything, please don't hesitate to shoot me an email at admin@wcypodcast.com or just email wcypodcast@gmail.com. Either one, I will get that email personally and I will respond no matter how long it takes. Maybe I really hope I don't sit on it for too long. It happens sometimes though, a couple weeks, but I will answer your email, so don't fret. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.